Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Tonight, we're stepping back, way back, into the fog of history, to 1888.
A truly chilling period.
We're focusing on a case that really defined modern true crime in many ways.
Absolutely. It still resonates.
Imagine London, specifically the East End. Gaslit streets, thick fog. Mm-hmm. It sounds almost cliche, but it was real. And something terrifying was happening in Whitechapel.
The name everyone knows. Jack the Ripper.
Exactly. The phantom killer whose name just became this instant shorthand for, well, for terror and chaos.
Hmm.
So our mission here is to, you know, try and cut through some of the myth, the legend that built up over 130 years.
It's a tall order.
It is. We want to look at the facts from the sources. Hmm. What allowed this to happen? Why did the investigation seemingly fall apart?
And that big question, why are we still so gripped by it? Why does this anonymous figure still feel so present?
Yeah.
So we're drawing on historical accounts, bits from detective notes, social commentary from the time itself. It's really an anatomy of fear.
Not just the murders themselves?
No, not just that. It's about how extreme poverty, systemic failures, really, how they created the conditions for this reign of terror. It forced Victorian London to confront a darkness it had tried very hard to ignore.
Right. And to understand the Ripper, you absolutely have to start with Whitechapel. You can't separate the killer from his hunting ground.
No, the context is everything.
Our sources, they paint this incredibly bleak picture, don't they? Autumn 1888, the East End described as, I think the phrase was, choking with poverty and desperation.
It's hard for us to truly grasp the reality. This wasn't just, you know, being poor. It was bordering on anarchy.
How so?
Well, you had massive overcrowding, immigration waves, families packed sometimes 6-7 people into one tiny room. Sanitation was almost non-existent.
The disease was everywhere.
Rampant. And crime, obviously. Life was incredibly cheap. Anonymity was almost guaranteed because of the sheer density and desperation.
It sounds like a place where someone could easily disappear or be made to disappear.
Precisely. And thousands of women, completely marginalized, were forced into sex work just to survive. Literally for pennies to afford a bed in a lodging house for the night.
Often in these gin-soaked taverns, as the sources put it.
Yes. That extreme vulnerability, that was the hunting ground. If a woman went missing, especially one working the streets, the police, well, they were overwhelmed.
And probably quite dismissive of the victims.
Often, yes. And the environment itself, those dark, twisting, unlit alleys, the constant movement of people, a predator could blend in. They could strike and vanish very easily.
And it's into this chaos that the terror really begins. August 31st, 1888.
Mm-hmm. The start date.
That's when Marianne Nichols, Polly Nichols, was found on Bucks Row. And the sources describe immediate shock, right? Her throat cut, severe mutilation. This wasn't typical violence, even for Whitechapel.
No, it was a clear escalation from the start. But what really cemented the fear was how quickly it happened again.
Annie Chapman, just over a week later.
Exactly. And the violence was worse. The killer was bolder, more confident, seemingly unafraid of being caught.
Then you get the double event, September 30th.
Unbelievable audacity.
Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes murdered just hours apart in different locations.
That night really amplified the panic tenfold. Killing two women on the same night. It felt like total anarchy, like the killer could be anywhere, do anything.
And the way they were killed, you mentioned the killer's method.
Mm.
The sources talk about them being staged.
Yes, particularly with Eddowes. The mutilations were extensive, almost ritualistic. It suggested more than just rage. It felt like a deliberate act to horrify the public.
And to taunt the police.
Absolutely, mocking them. She was found practically on the doorstep of the City of London, where a different police force operated. That's when those theories started. Maybe a doctor, maybe a butcher, someone with anatomical knowledge, because the cuts were so specific.
But the absolute peak, the crescendo of horror, that was Mary Jane Kelly, November 9th.
The last of the canonical five.
And that scene was different, wasn't it? It was indoors.
That change is critical. It implies the killer took an immense risk, spent a long time at the scene. Not a quick attack in an alley.
What happened there?
It was horrific. She wasn't just killed in her room. She was extensively mutilated, dismembered. It was a sustained, brutal act. That final murder left absolutely no doubt about the monstrosity they were dealing with.
The public reaction must have been just absolute terror.
Complete panic. Vigilante groups started forming. People were accusing neighbors. The whole city was on edge.
But the awful truth is, the killer operated partly because the investigation itself was, well, a mess from the start.
Mm-hmm. Scotland Yard was scrambling, yes, but plagued by internal problems.
The sources use pretty strong language.
Yeah.
Corruption, incompetence, and betrayal.
It points to a real systemic failure. I mean, think about it. No real forensics back then. Fingerprinting wasn't standard. DNA. Centuries away.
So they relied on eyewitnesses.
Eyewitnesses who were often unreliable, scared, sometimes intoxicated. And then there was the jurisdiction issue.
Ah, yes, the police infighting.
Exactly. You had the Metropolitan Police covering most of Whitechapel, but Catherine Eddowes was found in the Square Mile, the city of London, which had its own smaller police force.
And they didn't play well together.
They clashed constantly. Information wasn't shared properly. Leads got lost in the shuffle. Evidence handling was, well, negligent by today's standards.
Speaking of evidence, this is when the letters start appearing, right? That infamous name.
Jack the Ripper. Yes. The media absolutely poured fuel on the fire. Those letters, the Dear Boss letter, the Saucy Jackie postcard, they turned a horrifying local crime into this global sensation.
Creating a personality for the killer.
A taunting theatrical villain. Now, were they genuinely from the killer? Or a cool hoax, maybe by a journalist? The sources debate this endlessly.
But the effect was the same either way.
Devastatingly effective. It gave the faceless terror a name and a voice mocking the police.
And how did the police handle that? On top of everything else.
Chaotically, they were chasing thousands of leads, interviewing countless men based on flimsy descriptions. And then there's the Gulston Street Graffito incident.
Right after the Eddowes murder. Tell us about that.
Okay, so near where a piece of Eddowes' bloodied apron was dropped, there was chalk graffiti on a wall. Something like, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing."
Highly inflammatory, especially given the anti-Semitic tensions at the time.
Extremely. The police commissioner, Sir Charles Warren, saw it and ordered it washed off immediately.
Why?
To prevent anti-Jewish riots, which were a real fear. But in doing so,
he destroyed potential evidence. Handwriting, maybe trace evidence.
Yeah.
Gone.
Exactly. It showed how political concerns and fear of public disorder sometimes overruled the actual investigation. All these failures combined, the infighting, lack of science, political interference. It's no wonder the commissioner eventually resigned. The pressure was immense.
So the investigation is floundering, the media is creating a legend, but who do people actually think he was? The theories have always been pretty wild.
Oh, completely. And the theories really tell you more about Victorian fears than anything else.
What were the main ones?
Well, the early ones focused on skill. The doctor or surgeon, that idea of cold clinical precision.
The knowledge of anatomy.
Right. Or the butcher, someone skilled with a knife, familiar with dismemberment, perhaps desensitized to blood. These theories were almost comforting in a grim way. They narrowed it down.
But then there are the theories pointing upwards, towards the establishment.
Yes. And those tapped into deep social anxieties. The gentleman killer theory was powerful. The idea that someone from high society, protected by wealth and influence, could be doing this.
That privilege could literally allow you to get away with murder.
Exactly. It spoke to the hypocrisy and the class divisions of the time. And that eventually spiraled into the more sensational theories, a royal connection, a Masonic conspiracy, things reaching right to the top.
Whispers and rumors.
Mostly. But what's crucial, analytically, is that the Ripper almost became more than a person. He became a symbol.
A symbol of what?
A mirror reflecting Victorian society's darkest aspects. Poverty, yes, but also rampant misogyny. The chilling idea that these women's lives were disposable. He exposed the rot beneath the respectable surface. High society couldn't ignore the East End's misery when it was splashed across the front pages in such a brutal way.
He forced them to look.
He did. He embodied the terror of the unknown, but also the known evils they preferred not to see.
And the legend, the mystery, it persists largely because of how it all just stopped.
Abruptly. After Mary Jane Kelly's horrific murder in November 1888, silence.
No more bodies definitively linked to him. No more credible letters. He just vanished.
That silence is perhaps the most enduring part of the mystery, isn't it? It leaves this void that's been filled with speculation for over 130 years.
What are the main possibilities for why it ended?
Well, maybe he was caught for another crime and imprisoned or institutionalized, his connection never made. Perhaps he died illness, accident, suicide.
Or maybe he just stopped.
Or just stopped. or left London, maybe went overseas, just melted back into the anonymity London provided, as the sources suggest, satisfied with the chaos he left behind? We simply don't know.
And that absolute blank space where his identity should be, that's what keeps him alive, in a way.
It ensures he always slips away. It allows every generation to project its own fears onto that shadowy figure. The mystery itself becomes the source of the terror.
Okay, so let's try and summarize the key things we've unpacked here.
Right. First, the Whitechapel murders weren't just random act. They were deeply tied to the extreme poverty and neglect of the East End. That environment enabled the killer.
Mm-hmm. Second, the investigation was severely hampered.
Fatally undermined by incompetence, by police infighting, the lack of forensic tools, and even political decisions overriding the investigation.
And finally, the Ripper himself.
His lasting impact isn't just as a serial killer, but as this enduring cultural symbol embodying society's failures, its fears, particularly regarding violence against its most vulnerable.
So the final thought, the one that lingers from digging into this darkness from 1888.
It's unsettling.
It really is. The ultimate horror of Jack the Ripper isn't just what he did, but that he was never identified. He dissolved back into the fog.
Which means
the terrifying possibility is that he could have been anyone. Not necessarily some mad genius or nobleman, but maybe just an ordinary man, the person next door, the man walking beside you.
And that anonymity, that potential for evil to be anywhere unseen, that's why the shadows of Whitechapel never really faded, have they?
Yeah, they haven't.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.